Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a selection of handcrafted party trays for Thanksgiving hosts as well as attendees, including everything from artisan cheeses to a variety of desserts.
For years, Michael Sheikh worked investigating war crimes in conflict zones around the world, places like Afghanistan and Sri Lanka and Myanmar. And he writes about how violence can destroy human culture, like art and music. But he was surprised to see how it could even target what people prepared and ate, how subjugation and repression could just wipe out ingredients and dishes from deeply held food traditions. This realization came to him during a meal in Kabul in 2007.
This is one of my last nights in Afghanistan after having lived there for several years. And I was incredibly exhausted. My body ached from putting my life into bags and suitcases. I really just kind of wanted to get on a plane. And that afternoon, a dear friend of mine, Tamim, had called me and he had ordered me over to dinner. It was going to be one of my last meals in the country. I remember standing outside of Tamim's house that evening and snow had just blanketed Kabul. And there had been a bombing and it had kind of rattled the city. And the snow had just kind of put the city in this kind of moment of peace. It felt like it had erased a little bit of the tragedy that the city had gone through that day. When I got there, there was this incredible meal spread out on the table. And there was a dish in particular that I hadn't seen before. This beautiful stew of chickpeas. It was golden and it was thickened with this really garlicky yogurt. Cumin, turmeric, and coriander, onions kind of smacked you in the face in the nicest way possible. It's a really beautiful and luscious curry, and it's something that you can eat almost in any season. It completely disoriented me, like stepping out of an airport into a new country for the first time, because I hadn't tasted anything like that to this point in the country, nor seen anything like that. I looked at Tamim, and Tamim is an Afghan man who had come back to Afghanistan to help rebuild. But like many Afghans, he had been a refugee many times in his life. And I thought that this meal that was on the dinner table that night was an amalgamation of all of his experiences and the places that he lived. I asked Tamim if the dish that I was eating in front of me, this chickpea stew called Salande Nahud, was Afghan. And he's like, yes, it is Afghan. And I thought it was something different. And by asking that question, is this Afghan? We started having this incredible conversation about the reasons why Afghanistan was at war in the first place. And in those moments, I started to see how the violence was starting to change the culture around Afghanistan in a much broader way. That meal and that question opened my eyes to seeing how that violence was also kind of disappearing Afghanistan's food culture one recipe at a time. Tamim explained to me how that violence had forced people to forget a lot of their food traditions. And so it really kind of opened my eyes and my heart to be able to think about the culinary and cultural consequences of the violence that I was investigating, the violence inflicted upon humans. But seeing the broader impacts of that beyond just the families to how it was changing the society around the families and the communities, the politics, the art, the music, the architecture, and the food.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Shake's book is called The Last Sweet Bite. And in it, he explores these six conflict zones where violence and war and displacement have erased the cultural memory that create these food traditions. The book is anchored by food. It's anchored by recipes to show how ingredients and flavors can shape identity and resilience. It's really about how cooking can be an act of resistance. The first recipe in the book, though, doesn't really come from a war zone. This comes from early in Shake's life when he taught English in southern Japan, and it revealed to him his first real understanding about how food can be what he calls an umbilical connection to culture.
I lived in this small little fishing village called Takanabe, and there was a little izakaya, a Japanese restaurant bar that I would go to every night, and it was owned by this incredible woman named Keiko, who was a single mom, and she was a widower, and her kind of kids had grown up. But I went into this izakaya that she ran, and she kind of took me under her wing, and you know, she became my surrogate mother for the 2 years I was there. And I spent a lot of time in that izakaya, both in the front of the bar drinking and on the backside of the bar doing dishes on busy nights.
Shucking oysters, too.
Yeah, shucking oysters, right. And I occasionally, you know, she got worried that I was, you know, I was single and I was living alone in Japan, and therefore that I wasn't eating well except when I was in her izakaya. Yeah. So she taught me how to cook. On one of the slow nights in the restaurant, she brought me behind the bar, and we would go through these impromptu cooking classes. And in one case, I mean, I remember her teaching me how to cook karaage, this beautiful fried chicken. Mm. This book, if I have to simplify it into one sentence, it's a book about how violence and wars change culinary traditions, how it disappears some recipes, and these exceptional yet overlooked home cooks and human rights activists and chefs fighting to keep their food cultures alive. And I wanted to show how this phenomenon was happening in real time, not looking at kind of going back to Genghis Khan, maybe running through the steppe, something that was very tangible and people could see it in real time. So I these recipes are very much about the food traditions that people are keeping alive today and things that were threatened very recently. While Keiko's karaage in particular is an older recipe, it is something that is quite new in Japan's culinary repertoire. And it's something that was related to basically the post-war years when Japan was trying to bring in more protein to feed its population after World War II. And there was and chickens were raised as a way to make up for some of those protein deficits. Listen, if you have a lot of chicken, what are you going to do with it? You're going to fry it. It's really good.
Yeah.
But this is a very special recipe that it was developed in the south of Japan, where I lived and where Keiko's family's from. And it's marinated in this beautiful soy, sake, garlic, ginger marinade for hours, if not overnight, and then double fried in rice flour that gives it this like shattery crunch. It's one of the most beautiful fried chicken recipes out there in my mind. But it is a tangible connection for me personally to that place where I live, but also a tangible representation of the history of kind of violence and the impact on the culinary culture and how people respond to that, to feed their families, to enjoy themselves, to get the calories they need, not in those specific orders, but it's a way that we survive, right? And each recipe in the book is like that. Each recipe I find is a roadmap for survival and happiness, and also a gift to all of us. There are things that people fought so hard to keep alive, and they were gifts for me to share, mostly given to me with the express intention that I do share them with the world. And so what I really like about these recipes is that they are kind of the tangible expression of the people that you meet in the book, these very powerful and often traumatic events they live through, but also these really tangible expressions of survival, hope, and persistence to live and be happy.
So I think it's important to say, as you mentioned in the book, you're not a food writer. You're something else, and we'll get to that in a bit. You're a consumer of food. But I wanted to ask you about this. Like, maybe break down for us how it is that food is history and identity and language. Is it because food draws on land and draws on experience, and food is part of a social process, you know, eating and gathering and preparing? Like, what do you understand about what it is about food that becomes a language and so much a part of an identity?
Going back to this idea of other forms of cultural heritage, right? Art, architecture, music, we have museums for them. We all understand that they are inherently important to human culture. I think with food and to a lesser extent language, they don't get the same sort of attention and protection in wartime that other forms of culture do. And I think this is a really profound problem. And one of the reasons why I think this is a profound problem is because food is devalued primarily because it's historically been done by women and girls as a form of culture. These culinary changes should happen on a community's terms, not an invading army's terms. And why this is important, I think if we want to protect food, if we care about food, we need to care about the people making our food and then care about what's happening to them. And I think that's particularly important with women and girls. Where do women and girls spend most of their time? In homes and in kitchens. And if we look right now across the world at conflict zones, you look at Gaza, you look at Ukraine, you look at Mungda in Myanmar, you look at Khartoum, you have this huge leveling of neighborhoods and homes. And I think that's a really important thing when it comes to food culture. Women and girls are the load-bearing pillars of food culture across the world, and we have to be better at protecting them.
I want to ask you about what it is that drew you to conflict zones. But before we get there, let's filter it through another food experience. You had a time when you were in custody by the Taliban. You weren't sure if you were going to live, or they maybe even might want to kill you. But the point of the story that I wanted to talk about was the meal you had. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah. So at the time, I was working for an organization called Human Rights Watch, and I was in a province north of Kabul called Tapisa. The Taliban were accused of burning down a series of girls' schools in that part of the country. The Taliban were vociferously against girls being educated. And I was up in that province investigating the crime of burning down these schools and preventing girls from going to school. I mean, in that context, it was a war crime. And on the way out of town, we were stopped by a group of insurgents, Taliban fighters, who basically said that I had no permission to be in that area, and held on to me and my translator for the day. It was a very, very difficult experience, not knowing if I was going to make it out alive. I was an American, but also Pakistani heritage. I have an Islamic last name that I think confused them a little bit. But while they were kind of determining my fate, I was fed. We all sat down together. It was a group of maybe 10 or 15. The memory's a little blurry at the moment how many people exactly there were. There were a couple dozen men there. How many I ate with? It was about 10 or 15, I'm assuming. I remember kind of having this kind of vertigo again, seeing this incredible meal spread out in front of me, the kabli palau, which is a staple of Afghan cuisine. There were kebabs or plates of dry fruits and nuts, fresh vegetables, yogurt. It was a feast, and there's no other way to explain it. And I, part of it was like, maybe this is my last meal. I remember it being very good, but it was also, it was like, this thought was like, my God, even in this moment, like, Afghans have this knee-jerk habit of hospitality, right? I had no, there was no love lost between those people and myself in that moment, but it was the most surreal experience in that it was just kind of this reflexive, habitual thing for these Afghans to treat me as a guest, even though they might be deciding whether or not I live or die. And it could have gone either way at that moment. But yeah, it kind of, in retrospect, it kind of nailed home how ingrained our culinary traditions are in us, right? And how they express themselves on any given day. Those Afghans, while they were Taliban, at that moment, they were Afghan first before they were anything else.
Do you understand what it is that interested you, I'll put it that way, in conflict zones, going out and investigating war crimes and human rights violations? One of the things you've mentioned is that you were drawn to stories of persistence and resilience and defiance. So do you understand what it is that made you want to go into these terribly dangerous, fraught places?
Yeah, it's two things. And one is, you know, the history of my family in some ways, but it's also the culture of my family. My mother's a nurse. My sister's a nurse. My aunt's a nurse. My father's a physician. My brother's a physician. You know, my parents in particular treated their professions as a way to give back to their community. And it was seen as a service. And being a member of your community in a positive way was something that my parents had always instilled in us. And while I wasn't attracted to the profession, the medical profession, I was still attracted to the idea of some type of service to help humanity. And I initially wanted to become a diplomat. And I studied in graduate school to move in. I moved in that direction during graduate school, and then the Iraq War happened, and I didn't feel that it was morally correct to go work for the State Department at that time, and so I started seeking out other ways of being able to help give back, and so I kind of went down the human rights path. And I think there was another thing that kind of propelled me into that, and I had always, since a small child growing up in Pakistan, partially visiting Pakistan often as a kid, I had become really interested in the human condition. I mean, I remember vividly seeing the inequality on the streets of Karachi and these beautiful mansions, and yet these impoverished people sitting on the street. And it was very challenging to me as a young child to see that. But you inherently know that it's wrong. And so I had been attracted to kind of this tension between seeing humanity and its different components on display in the same place. And then war and in conflict zones, you can see the best and worst of humanity. And I was very interested in those kind of, and like in humans and what makes us tick. And so I went like with open arms to these places, because that's where I learned you could see the best and worst in humanity coexisting in the same place. And I wanted to really understand that myself, but also, you know, see what I could do to help give back, that philosophy of giving back to your community and caring for community and trying to use your voice to speak up for the truth when you see injustice. And so that's why I was kind of attracted to those places, and still am in many ways.
And food was always part of that process, you've said. It's just that it wasn't until a little bit later in your experience that you really noticed that.
Yeah, I didn't really, you know, again, it's that meal with Tamim and asking that question, like, is this dish Afghan? And his explanation about how it was, but how people were forgetting how to make this chickpea stew, or how the ingredients were hard to find, and the impact on memory. I got very curious about that. And everywhere I went after that, as a human rights investigator, whether it was Sri Lanka or Myanmar or Bangladesh, Mali, Thailand, I asked that question in these interviews: how was the war changing the food culture? I wanted to see if it was happening in other places more than just in Afghanistan. And by asking that question, it opened up a profound window into humanity and what we value in terms of our culture and philosophies on life.
Michael Shake, we're talking about his book. It's called The Last Sweet Bite: Stories and Recipes of Culinary Heritage Lost and Found. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a selection of handcrafted party trays for Thanksgiving hosts as well as attendees, including everything from artisan cheeses to a variety of desserts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the human rights investigator Michael Shake. He's written a book about how violence can erase the traditional foods that anchor people to home. Shake calls food an umbilical cord to memory and place, and he says when that cord is cut, this impact can be really profound. We're talking about people in war zones and what the food they eat or are denied can reveal about survival and resilience. The book is called The Last Sweet Bite. As you mentioned, the book takes us through these various conflict zones. You tell the stories, you include recipes that anchor it. I want to talk about the Czech Republic first. This is the first chapter in the book, and it explains how communism and how the Nazis tried to erase the cuisine there. And I wanted to begin with the person who sort of guides you through this story, a man named Roman Vanek.
Roman Vanek.
He's this archivist. He's this scholar, I guess, of Czech. Tell us about him first, and we can talk about this particular part of the story.
Roman Vanek is one of the most special people I know. Today he is probably one of Czech Republic's most well-known chefs. But he got his start as a young photographer in Prague in the late 1980s, when the street protests, now today known as the Velvet Revolution, were taking place.
Yeah.
And he was photographing a lot of the abuses that the police were carrying out against protesters. And while he was technically working for the government, he was using his camera to turn the lens on what the government was doing to his fellow people and giving some of those pictures to the opposition to help kind of add some energy into the protest movement, which eventually toppled the Soviet-backed communist regime. He took some of the most iconic pictures of Vaclav Havel and the years after the Velvet Revolution. But he was always a cook. He was always a cook at heart. He's helped run a few of his friends, Student List, one of Czechoslovakia at that time's first student-run newspaper. It was like, I don't know, I guess it would be a cross between kind of like the New Yorker and maybe like a Rolling Stone in some way.
Yeah.
So that's what he helped found it. And it became a very popular magazine, but they used to just have these staff meetings and editorial meetings, and he was the one who was doing all the cooking. And one night, he and his colleagues decided to have like an editorial meeting in the catacombs underneath Prague. And they realized that then the brand new president, Vaclav Havel, the palace was the short distance away. And they had decided that Roman was going to cook goulash, and they were going to have kegs of beer.
and they knew that Vaclav Havel liked both of those things. So they kind of just went over, knocked on the president's door and asked him if he wanted to come to their editorial meeting. And lo and behold, to all of their surprise, Havel shows up with his guards. And they just have a really good night. But it's in that moment that Roman is bitten by the cooking bug and moves more in that direction and became a self-trained chef, eventually goes to culinary school and has opened a really great culinary school in Prague called Prakul. But he is also this incredible student of history. And in many ways, like I've talked about how like food has opened up, you know, windows into humanity. For me, on a philosophical level, Roman has taken that to an extreme, a really great extreme in some ways. He sees menus in particular as these windows into different eras. And you can, you know,
what does he say? He says menus are mirrors of the public mood.
At any given time, a menu is a mirror of the public mood. And he has this incredible collection of old Czech cookbooks and menus, probably the largest collection in the Czech Republic. And he really is a repository of what Czech cooking was like and how it developed, you know, all the way from the Austrian-Hungarian Empire till today. And he really has this incredible view of how the Austro-Hungarian Empire influenced Czech cuisine, how the Nazis, then the communists, then the Soviets, and post-Velvet Revolution. And he's got all these books that just tell that story. And Roman is one of these guys that wants his people to eat well. And he has just set out to make sure that people know what they're eating, how to cook it, and how to cook really good food. And I think that's what has endeared him to so many Czechs right now.
Roman's goulash is one of the recipes. It's the one that, I guess a version anyway, of the one that he cooked for.
Yes, yes. And it's an incredible recipe.
Well, I was going to ask you about it. Say something about it. I'm looking at it now. It looks like goulash, but like, I don't know if there's anything particularly extraordinary about it, but there's the bread, there's the paprika, of course, there's, I don't know, what do you want to say?
You know, this particular it's one of those things. I mean, this is a thing about food being magic, right? Yeah. Like, you know, you might cringe knowing that you need equal pounds of onion, the ratio is equal pounds of meat to onions, right? Mm-hmm. Like 2 pounds of onions and 2 pounds of boneless pork shoulder or beef chuck, right? Whatever you want to do, pork or beef. But it's an immense amount of onions, but you need it. And it's like the way that the onions just brown and become the sauce in some ways. I don't know. And there's some of the caraway seeds and the paprika and the pork that all just come together in such a magical way that they are really like the sum of all their parts. And it's really one of my favorite dishes in this book. And I think it did a perfect fall winter meal, and it goes really well with really good Czech beer, I have to say.
All right, let's talk about the Rohingya. It's one of the chapters focuses on the Muslim minority in Myanmar.
Yes.
Faced, of course, decades of persecution and displacement and all kinds of violence. The character here I wanted to ask you about, because it seems like all of the books are not only anchored by food, but at least one great character. And in this particular section of the book, it's Miriam. Tell us about her and the role she played in telling the story.
Yeah, Miriam is a very special human being. So Miriam is now a refugee in Bangladesh. She was forced to flee in 2017 during this very nasty period of genocidal violence where the Myanmar government forced nearly a million Rohingya from their homeland in Myanmar across an international border into Bangladesh. But I had the privilege of meeting Mariam's family in their own homeland in Rakhine when I was working for the UN. The thing about the Rohingya is they are incredibly special people. There's only, you know, 2 to 3 million of them in the world. They are an endangered people, a lot like their food.
years, decades of an erasure campaign by the Myanmar government to get them out of the country, to erase them off the face of Myanmar. Yeah. It's been pretty effective, and it's terrible. And it's pushed most of the Rohingya into being refugees around the world. And so Mariam, in her family and in her neighborhood in Rakhine, she was known as a very good cook, a special cook, someone who paid attention to what was happening on the land, like most Rohingya do. I mean, there's something that the Rohingya kind of imbued in me, both in Myanmar and in Bangladesh, and seeing them and talking to them and walking their lands with them, is that it's really where God, Allah, perfected eating well off the land. It is an incredibly beautiful place, an incredibly lush place. Food and plants and animals are used in a very sustainable way. The land and the rhythms of harvesting and fishing bind not only the Rohingya to the land, but to each other. And so by having forced, Mariam had been central to this with her family. She had understood, you know, the unique plants that were growing in her garden, not only from a nutritional perspective, but also medicinal perspective.
Yeah.
And these were things that Rohingya women in particular had transferred down through the generations. That's how people knew to keep growing certain foods, how they knew that certain animals only ate certain types of feed. And like these things kind of work together. And Mariam in the camp, after she was forced out, her and her family were forced across Myanmar into Bangladesh, has kind of taken it upon herself to ensure that not only her children, but also the community around her in her part of this sprawling refugee camp. I mean, it's a million people or more. And it's a, you know, it's a really kind of heartbreaking place in a lot of ways. But Mariam has decided to find joy by cooking and by and particularly with the express intent of keeping her culture alive by cooking. So she can, using food as that language,
yeah,
to transmit all this knowledge I was just talking about certain plants, about certain ways of cooking, about hospitality traditions, about certain ways of eating, to her children and her neighbor's children.
Well, and I think let's focus on some food then. And
yeah,
this gets us to Goro Guso. This is her, Mariam's beef curry dish. Describe it. One of the words you use is fiery.
It is fiery.
Yeah, it's a
the Rohingya,
it's a beef curry.
The beef curry. The Rohingya have a Herculean tolerance for chili. It's amazing. I mean, there are very few places where I've eaten where like, oh my God, I can't eat this. It's too spicy. But it is, it's worth it. And this recipe, I don't want to turn listeners off by it because of the heat. You can dial it up or dial it down as much as you want to. But it's a very important curry. This beef curry is something that is cooked on very special occasions. It's something that's often cooked for guests. It's cooked on special holidays as a way that then the better off in the community will make enough of it to give it to the poor on Eid, for example, one of the holy days in Islam. By making this curry for your neighbors, it's a way for the Rohingya, you know, those who are well off, to reinforce their responsibility for caring for their community. It's also a way to reinforce the leadership structures of a community. If there is a recipe that ties the Rohingya to the land, it's this, because of the beef. The cattle graze in open fields, but two things have happened. One, because of the genocide inside Myanmar, with the forcing of Rohingya off of their land into Bangladesh. That land has now been appropriated by different elements of Myanmar society and the military. They've stolen the land. They've stolen the cows. That's pushed the price of beef up for Rohingya who are still there. So they're getting priced out of their own ingredients now. They can't make this because it's too expensive. But in the camps, the Rohingya, for the most part, they're not able to work in the Rohingya camps in Bangladesh. And so when you're not able to work, you can't earn money. And if you don't have money, you can't buy food. So the workaround to this is that almost all the Rohingya are reliant on international food aid. And that food aid is determined by big organizations like the World Food Program and the UN and others. And so there's not a terrible amount of variety there. There are informal markets in the camps and you can buy beef, but it's incredibly expensive. So it means that on this very special dish, people are having a very hard time making it. You know, how I said it was a dish that the well-off in the community would make for the poor to reinforce the social structures and the hierarchies and the organizational structure of Rohingya society. That is now breaking down because they can't afford beef. They can't afford to make this. They can't afford to give it away. And so it is having this kind of really profound impact on Rohingya culture inside the camps, and it's kind of weakening the societal structures.
Michael Shaikh, his book is called The Last Sweet Bite, Stories and Recipes of Culinary Heritage Lost and Found. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the human rights investigator Michael Shaikh. We're talking about his new book, The Last Sweet Bite. Let's talk about one more ingredient in the book, the section where you write about the Pueblo nations, the indigenous communities in the U.S. Southwest, particularly New Mexico. You first tasted amaranth in Albuquerque. This was the summer of 2021, I think you said. Tell us about those tortillas.
So, yeah, these are really special tortillas, and they were made by a really wonderful chef named Chef Ray Naranjo, who runs this beautiful catering and food truck company called Manco in outside of Española in New Mexico. And these tortillas are made with corn, a mixture of corn flour and amaranth flour. And it was the first time that I had ever recalled eating amaranth. And these tortillas were really kind of almost nutty. They were just beautiful and floppy and tore in the most perfect way. But they had this really beautiful, nutty taste that, again, was really disorienting. I never tasted before. And it led me to ask Ray about what was in them. And he told me about amaranth. And it's like, oh, okay. I didn't really know it was an indigenous ingredient. And it really set me on this path, like in many ways, like asking that question with Tamim, whether or not that stew was Afghan, asking Ray about amaranth, led me on this kind of years long research project into the history of amaranth, not only in Native culture, but also in broader in Western American culture. And it taught me about how profound this plant was to indigenous peoples throughout America. We understand, I think many of us understand the profound importance that corn has played in indigenous societies forever. But amaranth in many ways played an equally important role for many of them. But because of its importance, when the Spanish invaded Mexico or and sacked Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital, they saw the importance that amaranth is playing both in the spiritual realm, but also as a culinary tradition. It's a very protein-dense plant, and it offered a lot of sustenance to the Aztecs. And some scholars suggest that because that amaranth is so nutritious, it really sustained a lot of the Aztec warriors who really fought off the Spanish for a while before they're eventually succumbed. But it really kind of phased Cortez when he was trying to take over Tenochtitlan. And they ended up banning amaranth and saw it as a sacrilegious plant, cut under fields, banned its use as they colonized different parts of Mexico and South America. And that
ban really forced it out of the cultural memory for a lot of people for a while. It is now coming back. I mean, the resurrection of amaranth in Mexico has taken place a long time ago, and it is starting to come back now in other native cultures here in what is North America. But the Pueblo used amaranth quite a bit in their culinary traditions before the Spanish arrived. And when the Spanish arrived, they seem to have brought the amaranth ban with them into New Mexico, and when they colonized the Pueblo people. And like colonization everywhere, it really did a number on indigenous culinary traditions across North America. And it forced this culinary amnesia on a lot of communities. And now you have these food sovereignty movements coming back. You have really incredible chefs and seed savers,
yeah,
and indigenous leaders who are trying to revitalize large parts of culinary traditions that were intentionally attacked by not only the Spanish, but later the United States. And so that tortilla took me on this path to really understanding the role that amaranth played in old Mexica societies, but also in native Pueblo traditions and other native communities, but also more importantly, the role of colonialism undermining indigenous food traditions in the United States, and the legacy that is still very much alive today of that. Ray Naranjo, his elders, particularly his mother, Marianne Naranjo, and his relative Roxanne Swensel, and his other relative Porter Swensel, have really been trying to, along with other communities, bring back these old ingredients and focusing more on removing unhealthy aspects of their diets that has been forced upon them by the United States, to going back to what they used to eat in pre-Columbian times and how much healthier they have become. And it showed me in many ways this plant amaranth and the effort by indigenous communities, you know, across North America to revitalize their cuisines, that by doing so, by saving a cuisine, you can save a life. That was one of the most profound kind of realizations that I came through with writing this book. And it was that plant amaranth that showed it to me.
And of course, you include the recipe in the book. It's interesting. It just calls for a single tablespoon, but you say it's enough.
It's enough
to spread that flavor. Yeah.
It's enough. And you can dial up or dial down depending on your taste. You can adjust the proportions of corn flour to amaranth flour to bring out the nuttiness more if you like. But it's a really spectacular tortilla, and it's a really spectacular ingredient and plant.
Ray's mom, Marian, said something. She told you that things like amaranth don't always disappear. She said sometimes they're just waiting to be remembered.
Right.
So yeah. Let me ask you, do you think that there is, in all of the foods that you explore in the book, do you think there's enough cultural memory to keep some of these dishes present? Or if they're, you know, if they go dormant, can they be revived and saved? Like, what is there enough, or is it going to require a good bit of effort on our part to sort of keep them around? Paying, as you say, it's another really important idea. You say we need to pay attention to all of this.
Paying attention is key. Is it enough?
Yeah.
Looking at the Pueblo nations and Marian, and particularly what she taught me about the willingness and the fight to persist through 500 years of colonization, right? That the Pueblo and other indigenous nations are still here. That is a testament to that persistence, both for the physical, the spiritual, but I also think kind of that in that memory as well. And I think the point that Marian was making is that amaranth continued to grow even as the Spanish banned it. Because the violence on this plant, on the violence on these communities, and forcing them to eat other foods, forcing them to, not just the Spanish, but the American occupation of many of these nations, stealing their children from them, putting them in boarding schools, forcing them to eat other foods, to imbue in them West, you know, American culture, to basically become white, forcing the Indian out of them, right? It did a lot of damage. It did a lot of damage. But amaranth, for example, still grew during these periods. And it just, it took an effort to remember. And I think what Marion is saying is that we can come back, we can learn. The earth is still here to teach us what we need to know.
I want to ask you a question about this week. How are you thinking about, it's not directly related, but I'm wondering, do you think as people gather to feast, those who can this week, how are you thinking about that in the context of the book that you wrote? I mean, you talk about your mother's experience at Thanksgiving and Christmas when she was a kid, because there had been these disputes in the family, the holidays that she experienced when she was young weren't very big. They didn't have the whole family. They were incomplete. But as an adult, your mom built this new family culture. Now she wants to fill every empty space with family. So how are you thinking about, how do you think about the food in war-torn conflict areas and the food in, you know, in a wealthy country full of plenty and even excess this week? Like, how are you thinking about all of that?
If there's a message that comes out of my book, is that it gives us a way to survive and persist through difficult times, right? And the strategies that people employ. But it's also more about kind of the love, right? It's not just the love of food, but the love of culture and the messages that convey. And I think when we're sitting around our tables this coming week, and then, you know, throughout December as well, I think these are all moments for us to think about these traditions, what, you know, what they mean, that the food on our plate, I know we don't like to talk about politics on these days. I mean, we're all talking about, let's stay away from politics. We don't want the world to end at Thanksgiving table with someone getting upset.
Right.
But I do think it's important to understand why that food is there and why it might not be there in the future, right? I think if we're interested in food, we need to be interested in the people making the food and interested in what's happening to them. And it's not just those who have made that dinner, that Thanksgiving dinner right then, who made those sweet potatoes or who baked that turkey. It is about the people who grew those animals, who picked those vegetables, who delivered them to the grocery store, who in some cases delivered them to our houses. And I think it's being thankful for them, but also recognizing that they're going through a really tough time too. And they impact this great thing that is the United States and its American culture. And thinking about those people, not just about whether or not ICE raids are going to make our food more expensive. It's about thinking about the dignity of those people facing those ICE raids. It's about the dignity. It's about looking at it from a human rights perspective, that those people have rights, that they shouldn't be treated that way, that the food that we're eating is a product of their hard work and their care as well. And I think it's a moment for us to recognize we're all in this together. And that's the thing about gathering, is that we're all in this together all the time. And so I look at this as, you know, the word that I always come back to is persistence. We just need to persist through these problems and persist in having meaningful conversations around food and what it means to us. And that meaning is what'll bring us together. We all come together over food. It grounds us. And it allows us to have tough conversations. Food is common to us all. It's an easier entry path into tough subjects. I'm not one to shy away from tough dinner table conversations, but I think, you know, maybe this week, you know, you can use food to have more meaningful conversations around what's happening in our lives and our communities, and focus on our communities, because not everything has to, you don't have to go down the black hole
of social media to understand what's going on in the world. You just need to eat with your family and friends and neighbors right now.
Michael Shake, his book is The Last Sweet Bite, Stories and Recipes of Culinary Heritage Lost and Found. Shake is going to be in Salt Lake City next week. He's going to be discussing the book at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City next Thursday. And apparently there will be food. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.